British people accept homosexual ministers. But if they ever come here bringing their boyfriend along, we'll throw them out.
It's all very well for us to have an international alliance against terrorism, but some of our so-called allies have a very poor human rights record, and Malaysia is one of them.
Joyce and I feel really strongly that what we wanted the book to be was a history that had never been told before. It's a 50-year history, it's a 50-year story, and we really tried to bring to life the people who battled away their court because they're just a fascinating array of people.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. The Canadian House holds an uncommon debate on marriage rights, Malaysia's PM unwelcomes Britain's gay cabinet ministers, and two lesbian journalists examine U.S. Supreme justice and injustice. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm John Beaupre.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending November 3rd, 2001. Canada's House of Commons this week held its first ever debate on equal civil marriage rights for gay and lesbian couples. Openly gay New Democratic Party Member of Parliament Sven Robinson's private member's bill was debated under a procedure which denied it a vote. The debate failed to change the government's position opposing same-gender marriages, although some members of the ruling Liberal Party support it, as does the Bloc Québécois. MP Libby Davies, like Robinson, a member of the NDP from British Columbia, appeared to literally come out in support of the bill, declaring that she is in a same-gender relationship. That would have made Davies Canada's first ever openly lesbian MP, but Davies said later that she rejects labels and does not consider herself a lesbian, calling her current relationship a matter of personal choice. Robinson has vowed to try again to legalize gay and lesbian marriages, while Canadian gay and lesbian activists continue their campaign to win marriage rights in the courts.
Also in Canada, Alberta's provincial government this week asked a court for a six-month delay in implementing a ruling allowing gay and lesbian domestic partners to inherit in the absence of a will. Alberta is the stronghold of Canada's generally anti-gay Conservative Reform Alliance Party. The provincial government told the court it wanted more time to seek input from the public, as well as to assess such legal questions as how long a couple must be together and whether they must have a conjugal relationship to qualify to inherit. The court had already given the province 9 months when it ruled in April that Brent Johnson had a right to share in the life insurance covering his late partner, Larry Sand.
Inheritance in the absence of a will was also the issue in the U.S. state of Washington, where the state Supreme Court, in a landmark ruling, affirmed a man standing to inherit from his male domestic partner. A trial court had previously recognized Frank Vasquez's right to inherit from the late Robert Schwartzler, whose home, assets, and business he shared for almost 30 years. But then a state appeals court found that the law recognizing common law heterosexual couples did not apply to same-gender couples because they cannot legally marry. This week, the Washington Supreme Court said in its decision that equitable claims are not dependent on the legality of the relationship between the parties, nor are they limited by the gender or sexual orientation of the parties. A new trial was ordered because some facts in the matter are disputed. Schwartzler's siblings deny that he was gay and claim Vasquez was only a housekeeper.
The highest court in the U.S. United Methodist Church this week affirmed that openly non-celibate gay and lesbian clergy can be removed from their ministries. Although the 8.5 million member denomination has been sharply divided on the issue for more than a quarter century, a majority of delegates to its general conference last year reaffirmed the church law that bars so-called self-avowed practicing homosexuals from serving as ministers. On the upside, the denomination's Supreme Judicial Council required that gay and lesbian ministers be afforded the same due process rights as others and can be removed only by the action of their regional conferences or governing bodies, not by the unilateral action of their bishops. Four of the 9 members of the church's high court joined a supplementary opinion that compared the denomination's policy to the U.S. military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Republican former U.S. President Gerald Ford strongly supports the U.S. federal government treating gay and lesbian couples the same way it does married heterosexual couples. His remarks came in a telephone interview with openly lesbian syndicated Detroit News columnist Deb Price, who called the 88-year-old ex-president the highest-ranking Republican ever to endorse equal treatment for gay couples. Ford said, "I think they ought to be treated equally, period. I don't see why they shouldn't. I think that's a proper goal." Ford also supports passage of a federal law against job discrimination based on sexual orientation, and he applauded President George W. Bush's 3 appointments of openly gay men.
There were hints this week that Britain's Labour government is giving thought to legal recognition of gay and lesbian couples. Baroness Sally Morgan, head of the Cabinet Office's Equality Unit, said in an interview that she believed the government is watching with interest the growing debate on the issue, although she added that there would be no action soon and that there is no suggestion whatsoever that the government would move on the issue of marriage for gay and lesbian couples. When reporters followed up with Prime Minister Tony Blair's official spokesperson, they were told that the government has not formed a settled view, but is watching the debate closely. The spokesperson added that there will be a formal response as a private member's bill for registered partnerships makes its way through Parliament, and noted that the government is looking at London's new domestic partnership registry. The London registry that opened in September is the UK's first, and while it confers no legal status, it's intended to support partners in areas such as tenancy, pensions, inheritance, and immigration.
Uruguay's Chamber of Deputies has unanimously approved a hate crimes bill including sex, sexual orientation, and gender identity, among other protected categories. The bill provides for sentences of 6 months to 2 years in prison for acts of moral or physical violence and of 3 to 18 months for incitement of hate, contempt, or any other form of moral or physical violence. The bill now moves to Uruguay's Senate. Igelhurk, the International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission, has called for letters in support of the bill, noting that Brazil, Costa Rica, Ecuador, Fiji, Israel, and South Africa have similar laws.
The GayEgypt.com website is reporting what it says are dozens of arrests of gay men in a Cairo suburb and near the pyramids. The site says the Egyptian government is striving to keep the arrests secret to avoid the international outcry that came in the response to the May arrests of 52 men in a police raid on a gay-friendly Nile riverboat club. Those men, allegedly abused by police in detention, will be sentenced in mid-November by a national security court with no possibility of appeal. Hearings began this week for the lone minor arrested in that raid as he appeals the 3-year sentence he received in juvenile court.
There are no civil rights protections for most of the world's people with HIV, according to a survey of World Health Organization member nations. Only about 16% of people with HIV in the world live in the 21 countries where their legal rights are protected. In addition, only about a third of the 72 countries requiring reporting of HIV protect the identities of the individuals. Another 11 countries, with a total of about one-fourth of the world's population, quarantine people with HIV.
HIV has drawn a rare official reference to homosexuality by the government of China, although gay men make up only a tiny fraction of the epidemic's victims there. The latest official report on HIV/AIDS attributed 0.5% of new HIV infections to sex between men and offered an estimate that 100 to 600,000 gay Chinese have the virus. To date, Chinese prevention campaigns have ignored men who have sex with men, but the Ministry of Health is expressing a new concern to provide education for them. China's first national conference on HIV/AIDS, to be held in Beijing in mid-November, will feature sessions on creating programs and materials to reach gay men.
Halloween continued to be the gayest holiday in the U.S., although fears of terrorist activity led to increased police presence at major celebrations. In New York City, which bore the brunt of the September 11th attacks, the big annual parade in heavily gay Greenwich Village went ahead with attendance of perhaps 250,000, only slightly depressed from previous years. The so-called gay city of West Hollywood, California, attracted over 200,000 costumed partiers. And in San Francisco, despite several years of city government efforts to move the party elsewhere, tens of thousands jammed the Castro District.
And finally, this Halloween season, two costumes were not donned by choice. Coshocton County, Ohio Judge David Hostetler has had to do some creative sentencing, with the local jail severely overcrowded. When he found two young men guilty of criminal damage for throwing bottles at a car, he was indignant at their rude behavior toward the young woman driving it. So to teach them a lesson in sexism instead of 60 days in jail, he offered them the option of paying a $250 fine and walking through downtown Columbus for an hour in drag. He specified a dress, a wig, and a little makeup, requiring that their appearance be respectful and demure, not a bikini top and thong. With the help of their sisters, Jason Householder and John Stockham made their forced parade late last week, and people turned out in force to watch and tease them. Although local residents support the judge's move, some civil rights advocates reportedly complained that it was demeaning to transgenders.
That's News Wrap for the week ending November 3rd, 2001. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm John Beaupre.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
Later in the program, we'll take a look at the role the U.S. Supreme Court has played, for better or worse, in the struggle for gay rights. But first, when Malaysian Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad declared this week that he would expel any gay government minister Britain might send to his country, listeners to BBC Radio 4's Today program got a surprising reminder that the U.S.-led alliance against terrorism is built on relationships that are shaky at best. This Way Out's Lucia Chappell has the details.
The subject came up during an interview on November 1st, while Asia's longest-lasting ruler was defending his decision to run for re-election in 1998 rather than step down as he had promised. Mahathir blamed the problem with his intended successor, former Deputy Prime Minister and Reform Movement leader Anwar Ibrahim. Anwar is still serving a 15-year prison sentence for sodomy and corruption. His supporters, who took to the streets by the tens of thousands during his highly publicized trials, believed the accusations of homosexuality were part of a conspiracy to eliminate Anwar that was engineered by the prime minister himself. The court proceedings in the case were denounced by human rights observers around the world. Yet it was the Anwar conviction Mahathir pointed to as he told the BBC that the acceptance of homosexuality, and in particular the appointment of gay government officials, is a point of contention between his country and the UK.
You know, you can't have a deputy who is homosexual. Not in this country, you don't accept. Other countries, of course, they can have ministers who are homosexual. And that's okay, but not here. So we have to take action. It's done legally through the courts of law. And since I have no deputy, I have to stay on. I couldn't resign in 1998. Yes, in some countries, things are more acceptable, but in this country, a homosexual is not acceptable as the prime minister of this country. It's a difference of values. You see, British people accept homosexual ministers. But if they ever come here bringing their boyfriend along, we'll throw them out. We will not accept.
Mahathir's comments on BBC Radio 4 made headlines, and British officials were quick to rebuke them. However, gay activist Peter Tatchell sees a deeper meaning in the incident. Tatchell, who has a long history of involvement in the international human rights movement, told the BBC that the Malaysian Prime Minister's position is indicative of the tensions present in the anti-terrorism alliance.
In Malaysia, a consenting gay relationship is punishable by up to 20 years jail plus flogging. And this is probably one of the harshest penalties for gay relations anywhere in the world. But of course, you know, the abuse of gay human rights is only just one fragment of a much wider abuse of human rights in Malaysia, which includes things like detention without trial and the violent suppression of peaceful protests. So in the context, this doesn't surprise me at all. I mean, it's all very well for us to have an international alliance against terrorism, but some of our so-called allies have a very poor human rights record, and Malaysia is one of them. And it would strike me as being quite absurd and offensive if a British minister who happened to be gay needed to go to Malaysia to liaise as part of this international coalition against terrorism, but then was kicked out because he happened to be gay. I mean, what kind of alliance is that? I mean, I think we're moving into an area with some very unstable, unreliable friends.
In response to Mahathir's statements, the Foreign Office leapt to the support of gay minister Ben Bradshaw, whose Foreign Office portfolio includes Malaysia. There are no plans for either of the two gay cabinet-level ministers to visit Mahathir's country. For This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell.
I'm Ellen DeGeneres, and you're listening to This Way Out, the Gay and Lesbian International News Magazine.
Thank you.
That was without cue cards, people.
The Supreme Court of the United States is a complex institution, and it's had a complex relationship with the lesbian and gay community over the years. A remarkable book entitled Courting Justice, Gay Men and Lesbians Versus the Supreme Court, explores that relationship in depth. Journalists Joyce Murdoch and Deb Price, partners in life and in authorship, brought years of experience to the project. Murdoch has worked as an editor for both the Washington Post and the National Journal, and Price is the first lesbian to have a nationally syndicated newspaper column addressing GLBT issues. They tell This Way Out's Chris Allen what they discovered about one of the most secretive of U.S. government institutions.
In the introduction, you compare the research you did to that of an archaeological dig. Now, it was obviously difficult to get an insider's perspective on the court. How did you gather your information and from what sources?
Well, Deb and I sort of divided up the work. She mostly tried to track down the gay people who had fought their way to the court, and I took the task of trying to peek behind the court's velvet curtain. Very, very difficult to find out anything about what went into the making of a decision, even a decision that's 30 or 40 or 50 years old. So we went and we found that some justices leave their papers, and we were able to get access to the papers of many former justices. Also, I read hundreds of thousands of pages of official court documents. We listened to transcripts of oral arguments before the court. I talked to more than 103 former clerks. And it was an archaeological dig in the sense of we didn't know what we would find. We kept digging and digging and digging, finding sort of little shards of pottery here and there, and sort of trying to piece them together, trying to figure out how did all these pieces we were finding fit together? What was the story? It wasn't as if we knew the story when we started out. We didn't really have a clue about what was the story of how the Supreme Court had dealt with gay people. What we felt like we were able to do in the end was to piece together an important missing chapter of the gay civil rights movement.
Your book gives the reader insight into the personal lives of both gays and lesbians who have taken their cases to court and the Supreme Court justices themselves. Why did you choose to write the book from this more personal perspective?
Joyce and I feel really strongly that what we wanted the book to be was a history that had never been told before, and we wanted it for a general readership. It's a slice of gay history that gay people don't know. We didn't know it. And it was so much more rich and fascinating than we could have ever imagined. And so we really wanted to write it for a lay audience. It wasn't intended to be written for a legal audience. It's written in narrative form. It's written with a lot of rich detail about people's lives. And it's a 50-year history. It's a 50-year story. And we really tried to bring to life the people who battled their way to court because they're just a fascinating array of people.
In terms of the gays and lesbians who made it to the court, who actually fought their cases, Deb, what did you see that was the same about these people?
These are people who felt that they had suffered an injustice and it was something that they needed to fight to correct. It wasn't somebody else's job to fight it. It was their job to fight it. And whether they won or ultimately lost, which most people did, they felt better because they had fought their way to the court. They felt like they had at least stood up for themselves, and they stood up for other gay people as well. But for many people, it was really an individual battle. These were people who were pioneers, but at the same time, they weren't run-of-the-mill activists. They weren't gay rights leaders. These were just regular people, you know, a gay astronomer, a journalist, a school teacher. One of them was a hotel clerk. Average people who had the government crack down on them, come after them, harass them. And not only did they fight back, but in the process of fighting back, they were able to, in some way, restore the dignity that's taken away from a person by anti-gay discrimination and harassment.
Now, it's even suggested that Frank Murphy, a Supreme Court justice from 1940 to 49, may have been a homosexual. Joyce, what led you to that conclusion?
Two things. One is that Frank Murphy, at one point in his career, had been Governor General of the Philippines. And a few years after being governor, he received a letter from a man who had been a soldier in the Philippines at the same time. And the letter very clearly seemed to be a love letter from the soldier to Frank Murphy. Combine that fact with Frank Murphy never married. He was very, very close to a man named Edward Kemp. He had met Kemp in college. They had gone to law school together. They had fought in World War I together. They had started a law firm together. Then when Murphy went into politics, Kemp became his right-hand person every step of the way. Murphy was mayor of Detroit, governor of Michigan, governor general of the Philippines, U.S. attorney general. Every step of the way, Kemp was right there, including secretly writing Supreme Court opinions for Murphy.
In the course of telling each new court case, you also give the reader a context for what's happening regarding gays and lesbians in the larger society. In that light, Deb, why was One Magazine versus the Postmaster of Los Angeles such a significant case?
In that particular case, it was the first case that went up to the court. It ended up being one in 1958, and they set one standard of justice for both magazines that dealt with homosexuality or heterosexuality. But had that decision gone the other way, and the justices had said that gay publications couldn't be sent through the mails, it would have been an enormous blow to the entire rise of the gay and lesbian press, which, of course, without a way of speaking, since we've been so silenced in mainstream media, it's hard to imagine how the entire gay rights movement would have gotten off the ground. It certainly would have been hindered for years and years and years.
Now, more than not, as you said, the Supreme Court has rejected hearing cases involving gays and lesbians. However, the court's denial of an astronomer's case inadvertently led to the creation of an early hero in the gay rights movement. Can you briefly tell us the story of Frank Kameny?
Frank Kameny is one of the most important gay rights heroes that we've ever had. I mean, he's just an incredible person. In the 1950s, he graduated from Harvard with a PhD in astronomy, and he went to work for the government right at a time when the NASA space program was getting ready to take off. He was fired from his government job for being gay, and he decided to fight back. And his was one of the earliest cases involving a gay person as opposed to a gay publication. And what he did was he fought his way to the court and said it's not fair to fire somebody just simply because they're gay. The court ended up turning him away, but what ended up happening was Frank became so incensed that he became just a gay rights dynamo, and he ended up fighting for other gay people who were civil servants who were being fired from the government. He helped a lot of people in military cases, and he single-handedly is credited with having, in 1973, forced the American psychiatric community to get rid of the diagnosis of homosexuality as a mental illness, which, of course, was one of the biggest breakthroughs this community has ever had.
The Supreme Court has actually heard oral arguments on cases involving homosexuality or homosexuals only a little over a dozen times, generally ruling against them. In your opinion, which decision set back gay and lesbian civil rights the most?
Well, without a doubt, the Hardwick decision in 1986 was the most devastating decision for our community. That decision, sadly, it could have gone the other way. Originally, it was going to go the other way, and it would have been an enormous victory had all sodomy laws been wiped off the books in one decision. Instead, what we've had to do is go state by state, wasting an enormous amount of time and money to try to get the sodomy laws taken off the books. There's still about a little more than a dozen right now that are on the books. But what happens with sodomy laws is even if you don't have one in your own state, all gay people throughout the country are stigmatized by them because our opponents, the religious right, and just generally people think that they're sodomy laws and that they apply to gay people. In fact, almost all sodomy laws apply both to gay and straight people. So that particular decision, the Bowers versus Hardwick decision, was the most devastating decision.
Conversely, which decision do you think most benefited gays and lesbians?
Well, without a doubt, the most important decision is the Colorado Amendment 2 decision, the Romer v. Evans decision, which for the very first time said that gay people do have constitutional rights. It was very, very vaguely worded, which, in fact, is to our benefit, because this is a court that is we have very, very little sense of how much true support we have. I mean, that decision, we won 6-3. The Boy Scouts decision turned around. It was a 5-4 loss. So we don't know how far this current court, as it's made up, would really support our rights. So the Romer decision, which was in 1996, was a terrifically important decision because not only did it say we had some rights, but it allowed lower court judges to sort of stretch the envelope, and it will give us several decades to get the court, as it's changing slowly with society and its makeup is changing, to start filling in the gaps about what exactly does that mean that gay people have equal protection under the law?
In the conclusion of the book, you state, much like a ship trying to sail with its anchor still out, the United States is held back by the Supreme Court handling of gay cases. And yet you end the book on a hopeful note. Why do you do that?
Well, we feel tremendously hopeful in terms of the direction of the country, and we think that what our research really showed is that the court doesn't want to be too out of step with the rest of the country. So it is changing. You can see this change in tone and language best with the current Chief Justice, William Rehnquist. In the 1970s, he likened the reasoning behind why you should not have gay student group at a college campus to quarantining people with measles. Now, he wrote the majority decision in the Boy Scouts case, but he went out of his way to speak in respectful tones and went out of his way to say that the Supreme Court wasn't endorsing the Boy Scouts' homophobia. That's a huge change. I don't think it represents a change in William Rehnquist's fundamental attitudes about gay and lesbian Americans' rights, but what it does represent is that he didn't want the court to look like it was way out of step with the rest of the nation, and he probably didn't think he could keep a majority to get the decision he wanted without using that kind of language and tone.
Obviously, a tremendous amount of effort went into researching and writing this 530-page compelling book. Joyce, do you have any indication that people in Supreme Court circles are taking note of it?
Yes, we do. We've heard that it's being looked at very seriously inside the Justice Department. And in the Supreme Court itself, we read in the Legal Times, which is the main legal newspaper here in Washington, that, quote-unquote, the buzz is building in Supreme Court circles. So we know very well that the justices, their assistants, know about the book. And this is something that's going to have a big impact inside law schools, so that future clerks are going to know about this book before they even come to the court. So this is a story that the court itself has not known. The court is, in its secretiveness, it doesn't do a good job of creating an institutional memory. It doesn't know how it's treated gay people. So we are really telling it, for the first time, the story of what it's done.
I've been speaking with Joyce Murdoch and Deb Price about their new book, Courting Justice, Gay Men and Lesbians Versus the Supreme Court, published by Basic Books. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I'm Chris Allen.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, John Beaupre, Chris Ambidge, Brian Nunes, Jason Lynn, Rex Walkner, Graham Underhill, and Chris Allen contributed program material. Thanks also to Mark Armstrong. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen to This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. Just point your browser to www.planetout.com and click first on Multimedia, then on Radio. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded by direct charitable donations from our listeners around the world, which are currently being matched by a grant from the Gill Foundation. For an important message about This Way Out's tenuous financial situation, please visit our webpage at thiswayout.org, email us at tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on WORT Madison, Wisconsin, WEFT Champaign, Urbana, Illinois, and KGNU Boulder, Colorado, three stations we want to thank for their voluntary financial support, and on more than 125 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Everybody's going to stay tuned.